Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have the exciting part two episode with Dr. Joseph Farrell on his brand new book dealing with the three levels operating on 9/11. Before we get started, I wanted to say thank you for your enthusiastic response to part one and the deep research that Dr. Farrell laid out for us. In part two, we'll go even deeper. Now, in part one, Dr. Farrell outlined the three levels that were operating in 9/11 and the strange presence of a fascist international network that was deeply involved in these tragic events. In part two, we'll examine the exotic weaponry that was used to accomplish this great destruction and the technological manipulation of deep state plans dating back to the Reagan administration for continuity of government operations in the event of a doomsday scenario. Hold on tight. Part two of three episodes here dealing with 9/11. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell. 9/11, Promise, and Directed Energy Weapons.
SAIC is the corporation that was involved with the Pentagon renovations. All right. And the area being renovated, the first area to be renovated, was precisely the area where the Office of Naval Investigations had its offices, and which was the area that was targeted by Flight 77. SAIC had an engineer at one time that was working on reverse engineering the Nazi Bell and doing proof of concepts experiments for it. SAIC is involved up to its corporate earlobes in research of this nature.
You know, there are all kinds of contingency plans that a government will have for maintaining control in the event of a major catastrophe or war. These plans are an entirely normal and responsible approach to maintaining order in chaos. But there are forces deep in the national security state who would seek to utilize these plans for purposes very different than their original intent. From Operation Northwoods, where the Pentagon suggested to President Kennedy that he fake the hijacking of an American airline as a pretext to attack Cuba, to Rex 84, where Colonel Oliver North crafted in the Reagan White House a plan for martial law in the event of war with Central America. We've learned that many of the structures based on constitutional government can be manipulated by covert forces as a way to develop a police state. Is that what happened on 9/11? Let's go ask Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, hello everyone. This is a very exciting follow-up to part one and deals with the aspects of the exotic Tesla-like directed energy weapons technology that is in evidence on 9/11. And we certainly will complete the circle that we opened up in the last episode about Promise Software and secret codes. So heads up here, we will be doing part three on this for next week, so it's just too many revelations for one episode or even two, but I'm looking forward to this one. So make sure you've signed up for the Dark Journalist newsletter so we can keep you up to date right there in your inbox. Joseph, it's great to have you back for part two on 9/11 and directed energy weapons. Now, to get right back into this, you were outlining how the Promise software, which was stolen by the Reagan administration from the Inslaw Company back in the 1980s, was sold to foreign governments with these back doors installed as a way to spy on them, and became the mechanism for how this fascist international Level 3 was able to access secret codes and really blackmail the conspiratorial Level 2 operators who were embedded somewhere deep in the national security state.
Right.
While the Promise software story is an unusual chapter in deep state diplomacy for sure, and you do some real investigating of Michael Riconosciuto, who was the boy wonder electronics expert that they got to re-engineer the software and put in all these back doors to collect secret info from foreign governments. And Riconosciuto has been spending a lot of time in prison for a totally different matter now, but he has served at times as a whistleblower on this Promise matter.
Yes.
Now, he claimed he was threatened by the Justice Department not to testify on the Promise software matter, and because there were some investigations there in the early 90s. Eventually, they did put him in prison for supposedly operating a meth lab. Now, that's a 30-year sentence, but he does get out in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were brave journalists who really hunted down this story and were killed for what they found out. Danny Casolaro and his Octopus investigations, for example, they came very close to the core of this whole matter.
Danny Casolaro.
So yeah. I guess we could say that in the Reagan administration, so many of the seeds were sown for what Professor Peter Dale Scott has talked about on this show, which is the COG, or continuity of government planning, that really came to full fruition in the events of 9/11.
Yeah. Well, who was in charge of the COG planning during the Reagan administration?
Well, Oliver North and...
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney, of course.
And what does Cheney do? He builds an operations center in the Department of Justice, which is the one that North uses, and then he builds that one in the White House. And that is the center, I think, that Cheney went to on 9/11, or in his words, claims that the Secret Service dragged him there.
Yeah, they just grab him and hustle him out, basically.
I think the reason why that was done was it was already apparent at that point that the entire system had been compromised by Level 3.
Hmm.
So he had to get down to that operations room and assert the executive command, executive authority over the command structure. And then, as he's on the phone to Bush, he's telling Bush, you need to get to Barksdale and off it as fast as you can and reassert control. We've got a problem with all of this. And when Cheney disappears for all of those months after 9/11, what I strongly suspect is that he was doing was he was redesigning the whole COG, continuity of government operations, and trying to close out those security breaches in the entire system. That's exactly what I think they were doing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And the problem here with Promise, and particularly with Riconosciuto, is in my mind, even though Cheryl Seymour has done yeoman's work on uncovering aspects of the whole Promise Danny Casolaro story, no one has yet written a really comprehensive examination of that story as to exactly what the software itself was capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be done, because I think that this is a continuing problem, not only for the United States, but for other Western countries. Britain and Germany, it's very interesting, Britain and Germany, after 9/11, decided that they were going to completely overhaul all of their intelligence systems and get rid of the Promise software altogether. And that's a huge telltale sign that those two countries in particular knew that there was a Promise aspect to 9/11 that no one wanted to talk about.
Huh. Well, that is very telling, actually. Now, one of the most powerful sections in the book is the one dealing with the Pentagon attack. There's some very intriguing witnesses and information that you have there. One of the people you focus on is Frank Probst, who's an unusual witness that just seems to be in the right place at the right time in the heart of everything.
Yeah. Probst is the guy that claims that he was in the Pentagon and then he went out to a construction trailer to check on some things. And then after he left the construction trailer, he saw Flight 77 screaming in at ground level and claims that he had to duck to get out of the way of the wing and the engine. I think it was the left wing and engine. It doesn't matter. To get out of the way of the plane as it struck the Pentagon. And the problem here is if you look at Probst, he's apparently connected with technologies that are linked to, let's just say, the remote guidance of aircraft. And the researcher that I cited there is an excellent book, not very well known in the 9/11 Truth Community, called Another 19. It's about 19 suspects that this guy says should be investigated, not the hijackers, but these people. And Probst is one of these people because he's involved with some of these technologies. And so what he theorizes is that possibly what Probst was doing was putting a homing beacon of some sort inside the Pentagon with the equipment to control it outside in the construction trailer that was there, and that he's going around making sure that all this equipment is working so that the plane can fly into the Pentagon, all right, or whatever it was that hit the Pentagon. So yeah, he's a very, very fishy guy. And interestingly enough, one of the things he points out is that Probst is one of the witnesses that the federal government has placed under embargo. In other words, he cannot talk about his testimony in the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. He cannot and no one can have access to his testimony. So in other words, that whole thing is under embargo. And again, the question is why? Well, given his connections, you can kind of surmise what the answer may be, that they're afraid that something fishy about the whole Flight 77 narrative may come out. And Flight 77, let's face it, if you go back and look at the Pentagon aspect of the 9/11 story, that's where the official narrative really began to unravel first and the fastest, because there are so many, as I put a whole table of eyewitness testimonies about Flight 77 in the book.
Oh, that's an amazing section.
It is. And what you end up with is very contradictory testimony from some of these people.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you've got such conflicting testimony there about what happened. And so we have some people saying, well, this plane sort of melted into the Pentagon.
Right.
Other people saying that they saw something that was like a missile coming in. And then there are some people who say that there was nothing there at all. So one of the most fascinating witnesses that I found in there was April Gallup.
Yes.
Yeah.
April Gallup is a lady that was working in the Pentagon. She had a young son that she had placed in daycare. And she actually was involved in a lawsuit against the federal government, because after the planes hit, she states that she saw no plane and no aircraft debris. And she was in the hospital and was visited by black suit type of people that told her that it was a plane that hit the building. And she insisted, no, it wasn't a plane. I didn't see any debris from a plane, blah, blah, blah. And she was literally threatened by these people to modify her story.
Right.
And she was involved in a lawsuit against, which she lost, if I recall correctly, against the federal government about plane hitting the Pentagon, Flight 77. And let's be honest, there are problems with the narrative. We've got professional pilots saying that you cannot have a Boeing 777 flying that low and close to the ground in full flight trim at the speeds that they're claiming. It just won't work. It won't happen. You'll get too much of a draft that's going to force the plane higher than they claim it was, and so on and so forth. The hole's too small, and on we could go. The absence of debris. Well, there is debris around the Pentagon, but to my way of looking at it, not enough to come from an aircraft that big.
Hmm.
And the other problem even with the eyewitnesses who do say that they saw a commercial airliner, and in some cases the eyewitnesses are specific. They'll say it's a Boeing 777, and it was painted with American Airlines markings. Even these witnesses have a problem, and the problem is if a plane is flying that low in full flight trim, you know, engines screaming at full throttle, what happens to the wash?
Yeah.
Why weren't the cars just picked up and tossed across the freeway, you know, like a jet aircraft would be able to do if it's flying that low at full throttle? And, you know, there's nothing in any of the witnesses except one who talk about the wash.
Interesting.
So, again, there's a problem with the story. We don't know really what's going on with Flight 777, or pardon me, Flight 77.
And, yes, and 77.
The biggest problem is, as I pointed out, there was a German researcher who used a pseudonym on his website called Woody Box, of all things.
That's quite a name.
And yeah, and he pointed out that at Cleveland, there were apparently two flights on 9/11 that landed at Cleveland.
Right.
And the passengers were deplaned after they sat on the tarmac at opposite ends of the airport there. And they sat on the tarmac for a number of minutes, and then they were deplaned. And one of these flights, they were deplaned into a NASA center, where apparently they were debriefed. And the other group of people was deplaned, I forget into what. It was some intelligence community connected center. And again, they were debriefed. And we've never heard anything more about these flights. Who were these people? And he goes so far as to suggest that maybe one of these planes was actually Flight 77.
Yeah.
And that what hit the Pentagon wasn't an aircraft at all, but something else. And again, there's a certain degree of evidence for this. Rumsfeld himself, in a press briefing, made the slip up, you know, the missile that hit the Pentagon. Okay, well, wait a minute. Is it a missile or is it an aircraft?
Right, exactly.
We would expect the Secretary of Defense to be able to distinguish the two.
Absolutely.
So he thinks that maybe Flight 77 didn't crash into the Pentagon at all. It was landed. The people were deplaned and basically threatened, with their lives not to talk about anything. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting. Flight 77 is the most problematical of all of the flights.
Oh, there's no question. And that whole Cleveland episode, there were actually AP news reports that day that initially reported that Flight 93 had landed in Cleveland. And later they had the story that the mayor of Cleveland said, well, actually, it was a different flight out of Boston that they feared had a bomb aboard. But no real explanation. And so it's just off the charts, that whole story.
Yeah, it is. And you never hear it talked about anymore. It's dropped right off the radar screen. And I find that suspicious. That's why I included it in the book. You know, is there somebody out there that knows some more about what these two flights were and why these people were taken and debriefed in those kinds of facilities? I mean, NASA?
Yeah.
Really?
Whoa, it is strange.
What's going on here?
Yeah.
On top of all of this, Daniel, you have another eyewitness, and you pointed this out at the beginning of our talk, that says that it looked to her as if the plane had simply melted into the Pentagon.
Yes.
Now, what a strange choice of words.
Right. And she made the unusual claim that upon viewing it melt into the building, she felt somehow immobilized.
Yep.
And there was an arrested quality to her thinking after that.
Right.
Because it didn't seem like a plane crash. And later she had difficulty even remembering it.
Yeah.
But she knew something was wrong because the plane appeared to be just melting and then finally vanished.
Right. And again, if you know, we have no reason to doubt her.
Uh-huh.
If that's the case, then that's a signal, again, that there may be some very exotic technology. And we're back to Frank Probst once again. You know, was he tinkering around with some electrical equipment there that was literally making the phase of the concrete and so on in the walls of the Pentagon kind of porous so that the plane can dive or whatever can dive into it? Who knows?
Yeah, you really – go ahead.
It's just another signal of perhaps exotic technology of some sort.
Right. And that's what we are seeing again and again, which is that pattern of an unexplained effect showing up. Now, you do include in the book some of the very first shots taken after the Pentagon attack, showing almost nothing on the lawn in front of the building.
Right. And a tiny little hole.
Yes.
Which isn't, you know, many researchers have pointed that out. You know, I'm certainly not the first. Where's the plane?
Uh-huh.
Where's the debris? And then later, the government produces pictures of stuff inside the Pentagon that looks to be debris from something, but is it a 7-7?
Right.
And then later, it produces debris outside the Pentagon. You know, oh, well, here's a rotor from the jet. Well, if you look at the size of the rotor, that doesn't look like a rotor or even a compressor from, you know, a big, huge Rolls-Royce jet engine. So, you know, there's problems galore.
Now, you found some fascinating comments made by the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, right after 9/11.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us what he said?
Well, President Mubarak, this is one of the weirdest of them all, because President Mubarak, and you got to wonder, is this why they took him out, you know?
is this why he's rotting
in an Egyptian jail somewhere? Who knows? Mubarak gave an interview, I forget what network it was, within a few days after 9/11. And we have to remember something about President Mubarak. He was a pilot. He was an Egyptian fighter pilot, and he had also flown commercial jets. So in other words, the guy, you know, the guy knew how to fly. And Mubarak in this interview comes right out and he says, well, first of all, flying a plane that way through all of those buildings surrounding the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia, it's like an obstacle course is what he's implying. And you would have to know that area well in order to pull off that kind of maneuver with that kind of precision and professionalism. And the implication of his remarks is, Hani Hanger, no way could he be doing this.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the other problem here is in addition to this, Mubarak, you've got the testimony of the air traffic controllers at Reagan National Airport. You know, they're watching the plane flying towards the White House, and then all of a sudden, you know, it disappears. And you've got, in addition to this, you've got the AWACS radar aircraft in the area at the time, which is extremely fishy. You know, perfect platform from which to remotely control aircraft.
Oh, exactly.
If you want
right.
to. So, yeah, you've got all of this strange stuff about the Pentagon. And like I say, this is where the narrative began to unravel almost as soon as it was put out.
No question. And it's such an unusual target to hit right there. Now, you've pointed out that where it hit had actually been recently renovated and reinforced against that kind of attack.
Right.
And then right after the attack happened, the same company that did the renovation was selected to reconstruct that damaged section.
Right.
And then strangely, they also got the World Trade Center cleanup contract.
Right.
So that's quite a coincidence.
Yeah. And it's a company based in Sweden. The renovation itself was conducted under the auspices of, here it comes, the SAIC Corporation.
Hey.
Yay. The renovation offices themselves were the Office of Naval Investigation. So you've got all these suspicious connections. And in addition, there's one more thing we have to mention about all of this that's highly suspicious. And again, it's dropped right out of the narrative, even in the 9/11 research community. And that is Jim Mars uncovered the story about Secretary Rumsfeld's command center in the Pentagon was also hit. There was an explosion inside it. Now, for an explosion inside of a deep underground bunker to have occurred means, again, inside job, people with access, level two, and why haven't we heard about that? So in other words, the plane or whatever it is that's hitting the Pentagon is nowhere near the bunker. So how is this taken out? So you've got SAIC, you've got a Swedish company with, interestingly enough, German connections once again, doing the debris cleanup. You've got the same company involved as was involved in cleaning up Oklahoma City, involved in the cleanup of the World Trade Center, again, the same company. So in other words, level two's all over this.
Yeah.
And if they're cleaning up, if you have those kinds of companies cleaning up, particularly at the World Trade Center, my suspicion is they're cleaning up evidence of something very different from the official narrative. And many 9/11 researchers have pointed out that some of the cleanup crews at Ground Zero are in nuclear protocol. They're wearing the suits. They're following nuclear protocol for cleanup as they're cleaning that place up. So again, there's another indicator that there's some sort of technology involved there, and it ain't airplane fuel.
Yeah, definitely not. Now, you mentioned Rumsfeld there, and there is something interesting in the book that you have about him, that he was, and I find this just absolutely intriguing, he was putting together something called a space command.
Yeah, ain't that interesting?
It is.
He's putting together a space command, the key component of which is that all American military forces will be subordinate to this new space command. After, what I find really interesting, is that after 9/11, the plan is approved.
Oh, that's some timing.
Now, the question is there a relationship? Well, if you're dealing with potentially exotic energy weapons technologies with a component that's based in space, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, it makes a lot of sense. So, again, there's this thing. And let us not forget that Secretary Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11, gave that talk at the Pentagon where he claimed that there was $2.3 trillion of the Pentagon's budget that they couldn't account for. It's gone.
Yeah.
We don't know where it went.
That's just amazing. You know?
So, again, I don't think that's just an accounting problem. Let's put it that way.
And following that space command thing, you include a fascinating little interview in there, which takes us back to SAIC again. It's this man named Auschler interviewing a very interesting figure named Bobby Ray Inman about UFO technology. And of course, Inman is an enigmatic figure,
right?
Former NSA director, former deputy director of the CIA, and deeply involved with ONI, just a really hardcore insider. And yet known for a kind of independent streak and an interest in UFOs.
Right.
So what was it in this exchange that you found compelling enough to place it in the book?
Well, the reason I put that in there is that SAIC is the corporation that was involved with the Pentagon renovations. All right. And the area being renovated, the first area to be renovated, was precisely the area where the Office of Naval Investigations had its offices, and which was the area that was targeted by Flight 77 or whatever. All right.
Yes.
So in other words, that connection is there. You've got a connection to ONI. And let's remember what they were investigating. They were investigating all this financial fraud.
Okay? Right. Exactly.
Now, the other reason I put that in there is, as I said before, SAIC had an engineer at one time that was working on reverse engineering the Nazi Bell and doing proof of concepts experiments for it. And in addition to this, Admiral Inman, if my memory serves me correctly, Admiral Inman years ago gave a telephone interview to someone, and I remember hearing this on Coast to Coast or whatever, I can't remember what it was, where the interviewer asked him, I think it was my friend Tim Ventura or somebody like that, asked him very directly, was SAIC involved in anything that could be considered anti-gravity research? And Inman's response was, well, yeah, naturally. You know, it was kind of off the cuff. You know, it's like, well, of course, you dolt. You know, what else?
Well, he has a tendency to talk from the hip there.
Yeah, a tendency to talk from the hip.
Yeah.
But yeah, the reason I put that in there is that SAIC is involved up to its corporate earlobes in research of this nature. And when you have that coupled with witnesses talking about planes melting into buildings and Frank Probst doing whatever it was Frank Probst was doing on 9/11, the total picture becomes, well, we might be dealing with some exotic sort of thing, even at the Pentagon.
Right.
And that, again, would mean deep players at level 2 and deep players at level 3.
Right. These are the real inside guys. Now, you do an excellent job of pointing out that the Pentagon has surface-to-air missiles, anti-missile defense, that can be deployed in situations like this.
Yeah.
And we have all kinds of stand downs happening by the Air Force, and also the Pentagon defenses appear to be standing down during the whole incident.
Right. Now, the question is if the Pentagon has anti-missile and anti-aircraft defense capability, which one would only have to assume that they would, you know, it being the Pentagon and all. The question is, why wasn't it utilized? And for that matter, the White House has similar capabilities. And when Flight 77 is making a beeline right for it, and, you know, that whole U.S. Capitol White House complex, why weren't these systems used? Well, one possibility is that they didn't want to shoot it down and cause loss of life on the ground.
Sure.
Sure. The other possibility is they couldn't.
Huh.
Why? Well, let's remember Level 3 called them up at the White House switchboard and said, hey, we've got lots of these codes.
Right.
That means we can turn your systems off.
Yeah.
Or we can turn them on. You know, in the case of the nuclear missiles. So, you know, pick your poison. There's, to my mind, this is an indicator that the Pentagon strike may have been an entirely Level 3 operation,
mm-hmm.
not Level 2. After all, again, if you're Level 2 planning a covert operation, trying to inject American power, create a false flag to inject American power into the Middle East, would you attack a military target? No, not really. Unless you wanted to create huge loss of life, in which case, as I suggested before, you're not going to make this complicated spiraling maneuver through the obstacle course in Arlington, Virginia. You're just going to dive the plane into the roof of the Pentagon, preferably on the east side, not the west side, where you're going to hit important targets.
Yes.
So,
actually, they couldn't have hit a worse target.
Yeah, they couldn't have hit a worse target, yeah.
For a terrorist purpose.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think you're either looking at a Level 2 operation to cover up the financial crimes that ONI is investigating, or you're looking at Level 3 at the Pentagon. One of the two.
Yes, it's really fascinating. Actually, the Pentagon hit does stand out for its oddities. Let's talk for a moment about the flight that got away from the plan and crashed in Pennsylvania, Flight 93.
Flight 93 is the big problem. Most 9/11 researchers that I have been reading over the years strongly think that this flight was shot down. And the evidence, to my mind, for that is very strong. In that what you see at Shanksville, where supposedly it crashes, is again an extraordinary absence of debris. You don't see the passenger chairs. You don't see bodies lying all over the field. You see a hole and that's it. But other witnesses will tell you that there was debris scattered along an 8-mile long path, which does suggest some sort of takedown of that flight. And we know the official story. The people in Flight 93, there were people in Flight 93 that reestablished control of the aircraft, including, as it turns out, a pilot and an air traffic controller.
Right.
Who would have known how to reactivate the transponders and so on and so forth, you know, and get the plane back into the FAA grid. So they think the plane was shot down. The real question here, and I'm agreed with them, I think it was probably shot down. The real question here is why? And I suspect, again, that the reasoning of the 9/11 community on the whole here is rather sound. The last thing you would want as Level 2 is surviving passengers and surviving hijackers to tell their story. Because if they do, then the whole operation is blown.
Oh, it makes sense.
So you have to shoot it down. And it becomes imperative. And this is the key point. They knew at a certain point that the passengers had reestablished control over the aircraft. Because, again, we've got the problematic question of the phone calls being made. But there were apparently phone calls. I don't even get into the problems with the phone calls in the book, folks. But they knew that this had been recommandeered from the hijackers. That's the reasoning of the 9/11 community. And therefore, the shoot down order was, we can't have this, take them down.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that that's probably the case. There was too much of a danger that the whole thing would have been blown if that plane had landed anywhere. Cleveland, for example.
There it is again. Absolutely. And it's so unusual. In every case, the record from any of the planes is so odd, but the record from that plane is really unusual.
It's extremely unusual. And you have, in addition to this, you have eyewitnesses that report other aircraft in close proximity with it. One lady even adamantly insists there was a military aircraft, and so on and so forth. So again, Flight 93 is another place where the official narrative is, in my opinion, at least, in tatters. There's too much going on there.
You know, what's intriguing when we talk about these details on the hijackings and all the events, like the drills that were happening that day and the unusual movements of ATA. And, you know, it's so loaded with these telltale signs and clues, and it's just this mystery. But in the grand scheme of things, when we step back and we look at deep state activity over a long period of time, like you do in your research, and we certainly try to do here on this show, from the JFK assassination to 9/11 is a 38-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like 9/11 is really the culmination of the pattern. And I know you see these two deep events bound together in some way.
The Kennedy assassination and 9/11 have very unusual parallels. First of all, you have the problem of doubles.
Mm-hmm.
We know in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald that there was a double, possibly a triple in his case. With some of the hijackers, we know that Mohammed Atta had a namesake that was responsible for a terrorist bombing in Israel in, I think, 1984, which should place the name Mohammed Atta on a national security watch list and made it virtually impossible for him to get into this country to begin with.
Right.
And that means that for him to get into the country, there had to have been a national security override allowing him in. We know that there's cases of doubles al-Bukhari. One of the alleged hijackers on the initial lists of hijackers actually went to the FBI office in his hometown and said, I'm not the hijacker. Here I am. I'm alive and well. You know,
there are even more cases of that on that list.
Oh, yeah. There's several cases like this on the list. So the FBI had to revise the list, of course. And in many cases, you do have doubles. You have doubles out in San Diego of some of the hijackers as the hijacking is going on. So we have a direct operational connection or pattern between the Kennedy assassination with Oswald and 9/11 in that one respect alone. And then when we start looking at the mechanism explanation, well, it's airplane fuel weakening the steel columns and the floors come pancaking down. Well, first of all, there's no evidence of a pancake in the rubble, all right? A pancaked building will look a certain way. Look at earthquake pictures, and you'll see the floors of the building all just kind of on top of each other. This is not what you see at 9/11, but that's the narrative. That's the National Institute of Safety and Standards, of Standards and Technology, pardon me, their explanation of 9/11. That's the magic bullet of the 9/11 theory. So you have that aspect of it going on. The third connection between the two is if you look at the Kennedy assassination, you have occult symbols dripping all over the place around the Kennedy assassination. You have the three tramps in Dallas, that famous picture of the three tramps. Well, why is that an occult symbol? Well, if you know Masonic lore, that's Yabulo, Yubilon, and Yubila, the three thieves that in Masonic ritual kill King Hiram Abiff. All right. So you've got the three tramps in Dallas. You've got Dealey Plaza itself with this distinctive trident arrangement of the three streets that are coming together under the triple overpass. You know, that is definitely a symbol of Poseidon, of Neptune, of Atlantis, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. You've got all of this taking place in the Kennedy assassination, the ritual murder of the king in front of everybody, and so on and so forth. Well, look at 9/11. What do you have? Well, what are the Twin Towers? They're Yakin and Boaz, the two pillars in the Masonic lodge. And incidentally, I thought immediately when 9/11 was happening and I was watching it with my friend on TV and looking at the plane striking with the Twin Towers, I thought, oh my word, they're attacking the symbols of the Western power elite and its deep connections with Masonry. Around the World Trade Center complex, you had the World Financial Complex with three buildings with a completed pyramid on top, a stepped pyramid, an incompleted pyramid, and a dome. And again, these are all highly symbolic architectural things. It occurs on 9/11. Well, 9 numerically is the number of evil, all right? 11 is also the number of evil. And 11 itself is another symbolism of the Twin Towers. And on we could go. So there's occult symbolism that, with respect particularly to New York City and the Pentagon. What's the Pentagon? Well, it's a pentagram, all right? And what's the pentagram stand for? It stands for Venus. What was the call sign of Flight 77 that supposedly crashed into it? Venus.
Oh, right.
So in other words, the occult symbolisms of 9/11 are palpable, they are multi-layered, and therefore not accidental. So whoever is pulling off or designing the operation is deeply familiar with occult technique, with occult symbology, with occult ritual. You know, that was very apparent. And add to this the fact then you've got two levels, level 2 and level 3. Well, what's level 2? If it's the American power elite, what are the Bushes a member of? Skull and Bones. There's a secret society with obvious Masonic overtones.
Right.
So you've got the symbolism involved, and if level 3 is some sort of fascist international, well, were the Nazis fascinated with the occult? You betcha they were.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this was a planned operation, even in the, just like the Kennedy assassination, even in the occult sense.
So you call it an occult ritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a ritual of sacrifice. Because even the Twin Towers, if you look at the bottom of the cladding of the Twin Towers, what is it? It's a trident. It's a trident.
Right.
Which is also a symbol of flame and sacrifice. One of the jumpers jumping out of the Twin Towers is upside down, and he's got one of his legs kind of more or less straight up, and then the other leg bent and crossing over it like the Hanged Man in a tarot deck. So even that symbolism, you know, was there a big, huge canopy or, you know, jumper's balloon on the ground to catch him when he fell? Why is he falling in precisely that shape? So all of these odd little connections are there. And that, to my mind, means that this is an occult ritual. It's a ritual sacrifice, quite literally, mm-hmm. of innocent people. And the effect of it is just like the Kennedy assassination. Like Michael Hoffman has argued, this is the revelation of the method in the actual operation itself. And the revelation of the method, the actual act of sacrifice, is designed to shock and put people into a state of complete numbness and passivity.
So it's like a psychic shock.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And who of us wasn't psychically shocked? Think about the careful planning of it, even in choosing that particular day, because by that time, after a decade or so, what had we all been conditioned to think? Well, you dial 911, 911 in the case of an emergency. So now, after 9/11, every time we do that, what's the psychological effect? Subconsciously, subliminally, we recall that whole event.
Right. And there's no getting around it. Interesting. Now, one thing I want to ask you, and we should probably clarify at this point, is that the occult symbolism that was used was actually anti-Masonic. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I think, personally, I think that this is another part of the message from level three to level two. In other words, level two may have planned the entire ritual.
Right.
But level three comes in and co-opts it and turns it against level two. So in an occult perspective, you have one set of black magicians having all of their spells undone and turned against them, so to speak, by another set. Absolutely.
Well, it is compelling because in so many of your books, you delve into the secret societies, you know, the grimoires and the rites of ancient magic. Certainly the influence in the Nazi Party of occult practices and their deep knowledge and fascination with the subject. So all that comes into play, the exotic technology, the directed energy, Tesla weapon, and this overhang of occult symbolism on 9/11. Both of these things that you focused on in your 9/11 research are deep in the Nazi psyche.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let's remember another occult aspect in the aftermath of 9/11. We invade Iraq.
Yes.
In other words, we invaded Mesopotamia. And who had archaeologists digging up his country for him? Well, Saddam Hussein. Who thought he was a reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar? Well, Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
And who's digging up all these sites for him? The French and the Germans.
And the Germans, right.
And who do we tell to get the heck out of Iraq because we're coming in? The French and the Germans. Whose museum was allegedly looted by people wearing U.S. uniforms? Well, the Baghdad Museum. Who broke the story first? The Germans. So in other words, there may be even an occult, and I'm one of those that definitely thinks there is, an occult aspect to the invasion of Iraq. Why? I didn't say it. Jim Mars said it. If you think you're dealing with a group of people with access to extremely sophisticated technology that they may have learned about from their investigation of ancient texts and sites, what do? You invade the place where they're digging all these things up.
Right. It's a survival move. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that would be the key area for that kind of ancient technology.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Why? Go back all the way back to my book, The Cosmic War, which I keep telling people is the book that's the linchpin in the whole series of books. Why? Because in The Cosmic War, I reproduce the Epic of Ninurta, which is like reading the index of a Sears catalog. It's one of the most boring reads you'll ever read. But I put the whole text in there just so that people can see how boring it is and how it's not an epic. I don't care what academics say. This is not an epic of anything.
Right.
It's an inventory. That's all it is. But what is an inventory of? Well, it's an inventory of weapons that were used to fight that war with the gods.
Uh-huh.
And some of that, if you read it carefully, the text tells you that some of these things, whatever they were, could not be destroyed, and therefore they were hidden. Well, where's a logical place to assume they were hidden? Mesopotamia.
Wow, that really brings it all together for the linking of the 9/11 attacks to the invasion of Iraq. And it reminds me that the title of your book is Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. And with 9/11 in the subtitle, it is really something to link sorcery to 9/11. It opens up all kinds of vistas of what we're actually dealing with there. So, Joseph, just amazing information in this episode. Thank you. And as promised, we're going to go into overtime for part three. And Joseph, I know you've saved the best for last, so part three will be available for subscribers next week at darkjournalist.com. Of course, Joseph's website is GizaDeathStar.com. And hang in there, Joseph. We'll do part three right now.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating part two episode with Dr. Joseph Farrell on 9/11 and directed energy weapons. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
dark journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton-Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.